Fantastic. So you may have seen Julia yesterday when we had Jeanette Sadiq Khan doing these fantastic illustrations. So we've asked her back again today. She will be illustrating, as you can see above, the talk that Elliot and Bradley will be doing. But look, without further ado, I'm going to leave the field. I'm going to hand it over to you, Elliot, and let you take it through. Fantastic. Thanks very much.
Great. Hi to everyone. So I think I should introduce Bradley here. So Bradley Tusk is a political strategist and venture capitalist at Tusk Venture Partners. He was Uber's first political advisor, and out of their venture fund, invested in Bird. His political advisory career has also involved a rather fascinating collection of people. He ran Mayor Bloomberg's campaign in New York and has been advising Andrew Yang. Bradley, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Cool. Well, so I thought it would be neat to go into some of your background, first with Uber and then with Bird.
Sure.
So maybe you could take us through, the short version of your involvement with Uber in New York and regulations, and then sort of talk about how that related to scooters and Bird later on.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So when I started my first company in 2010, it's a consulting firm that runs big campaigns for companies. And I was sitting in a Walmart meeting in early 2011, and a friend of mine called and said, "Hey, there's this guy with a transportation startup. He's having some regulatory problems. Can you just take a minute and talk to him?" I was like, "Yeah, sure, whatever." I become Uber's first political advisor that day. I get really lucky when Travis calls back and says, "Listen, I can't afford your fee. We can take equity." I didn't know what equity meant at the time, but I said yes, thank God. That was during the Series A. And then spent a lot of the next few years running campaigns all over the U.S. to legalize ride sharing. And we've kind of faced the same playbook in almost every market, which was taxi didn't want competition, didn't want us to exist, kind of ignored us for a little while. And then as we started taking away market share, they finally woke up. While taxi hadn't done a ton to really improve their product or their service over the years, they were very good about hiring lobbyists and giving out political contributions. So they had friends, and those friends did what they normally do, which is do the bidding of their donors. And the only thing that ended up being different here was that we realized that we could turn our customers into political advocates. And by asking people to email or tweet or call or text in some way, reach out to their elected officials and letting them do so right from the app. Over a period of a couple of years, a couple million people did that, and that's what ended up winning the day for us in every single jurisdiction in the country. And so that was my experience with Uber. That's kind of my introduction to the micromobility space. Then out of our venture fund, started making some other investments in companies like Nexar, and I was over in Tel Aviv. This would have been fall of 17, I think, or 18. For some meetings, and I'm watching all these people kind of whiz by on Rothschild, which is kind of the main boulevard there, on electric bikes. And I remember thinking, oh, this would be pretty cool for New York. It would really fill a hole that we have in the market here. And that was kind of that. And then went back to New York, and 2 weeks later, met Travis VanderZeven, so another Travis, who was the founder of Bird. I think he had something like 16 scooters, the entire fleet at that point. But was raising his Series A. And I think because I had some sense of who he was from my time at Uber and some appreciation for the space overall. And then having just seen kind of an application of that, and I remember thinking, like, you literally just thought 2 weeks ago this would be a cool thing to have. Why not invest? And so we did. And that went really well, especially at first. Bird became the fastest company ever to $1 billion valuation. And then we worked on campaigns for Bird all over the U.S. to legalize electric scooters, and even today are working on their effort to be licensed in New York.
So if I recall from, a year and a half ago, whenever this was, the original thought in Scooterland was to sort of mimic the playbook where everyone just started putting these scooters on the streets of Nashville or wherever, and then, without first going through the Department of Transportation. And the thought was that there was going to be so much groundswell that they would just be legalized and it was going to be the same thing. Is that fair?
It's sort of fair. Why did that happen? Yeah, I would say sort of. So I get asked this question a lot. There are definitely parallels between ride sharing and the rollout of scooters. And then there are some ways that they're different. Like, right? So for example, in ride sharing, in some ways it was easier, in some ways it was harder, but it was more concentrated in that we had an opponent. It was, you know, taxi industry, and they wanted to kill us. And if we could beat them, we would win. There's no big scooter like stepping on our neck here and trying to keep us out of existence. But on the flip side, the rules for ride sharing, once we broke through that kind of resistance from taxi, there were already a lot of laws on the books of what you need to do to be paid to drive someone from point A to point B, right? Uber didn't come up with that notion of taking people to places for money. They just came up with a better way to do it. So the regulatory structure actually, in substance, already existed. With scooters, it is a much newer product, and as a result, there really is no regulatory framework in most cities. It's coming on board now. And so as we started entering cities, you had the challenge of a lot of very valid public policy questions. Should they be allowed on sidewalks? Or should there be bike lanes? Or should just be in the street? Do you mandate helmets? Do you mandate insurance? Where do you leave these things? How do you charge these things? And in fairness to the regulators, they were valid questions. And so the strategy, I would say, is a hybrid of what we did with Uber, which is if the law didn't say that we couldn't enter the market, then we did. So if it was gray, we came in. And, you know, look, no DOT thinks that you should ever enter their market without their explicit permission and blessing. So obviously they weren't thrilled about it. But, you know, if we waited for their permission everywhere, we never would have got off the ground. But the difference is there were cities like Chicago and New York, most notably, where there were laws on the books banning electric scooters. They were actually laws that had nothing to do with Bird or Lime or any of these companies. It was back during the whole Segway disaster, like in 2004. It was like a consumer protection law back then. But we had to overturn those laws. So in the jurisdictions where it was explicitly prohibited, we didn't sort of follow the Uber playbook. We didn't enter the market. We instead went through the legislative process to change the laws. In markets where it was not prohibited, we did go in. So kind of a hybrid.
Do you think that given how much the, you know, the cities have been, I guess, imposing caps generally, and that seems to be the larger regulatory structure that's in this country, you know, how much of that was a reaction to Uber and Airbnb some years earlier, where the regulators were sort of caught flat?
Yeah, I thought about that a lot and wrote about this some in my book. And I think that it got better and worse as a result. So in the first go around, regulators didn't really take startups seriously. Incumbents didn't take startups seriously. They assumed that they could just kind of push them around like they normally do with most people in their sectors. And then all of a sudden we had, one, all these customers who were willing to fight for us, two, a lot of money to be able to throw at the problem, and three, especially in the case of Uber, tremendous ferocity, right? Travis has pros and cons like any other human being, but one of his problems is not a lack of aggression. And so he was willing to fight it out absolutely everywhere. So that really took them by surprise. And as a result, they lost those early battles, certainly with us and to some extent with Airbnb, although Airbnb's approach was a little kinder and gentler, I would say. So then you fast forward somewhere between, you know, 7 and 4 years later, depending on when the ride sharing fight happened, to the advent of electric scooters. And I kind of noticed two things at the same time. On one hand, we weren't going to win by the element of surprise. They understood who we were. They understood what our playbook was. They understood the resources we had. And they were much more sophisticated about all of it. So on one hand, that's bad if you're me, because it makes it harder to win. On the other hand, it was also very good, though, because they took us seriously from the very beginning, right? They understood what we could do to them if it became a really ugly fight. The last person I think to not understand that was New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio. And after $5 million in TV ads, that drove down his favorability numbers to the 30s, and they never recovered years and years later. I think that everyone understands, look, we can't be cavalier about this. We got to take this seriously, but we also better understand their playbook. So it kind of becomes a fair fight.
Do you think that the companies, or, you know, the caps as they've been established, what's sort of the future for that, and what's sort of the hope for the companies? I mean, do you expect that this is just, okay, well, we'll start here, and then once people gradually like these, it will grow?
Yeah, I mean, keep in mind, you know, and politics ultimately is a business about consumer demand for what we call kind of voter demand, right? Every regulator, no matter how independent they feel, is typically appointed by some politician who is elected by the public. And I've worked in city government, state government, federal government, executive branch, legislative branch, run campaigns. The one thing I learned for sure in my time in government politics is 99% of politicians only care about reelection at the expense of everything else. And so it's actually in some ways very easy to read them and kind of move them to where you want them to be, because fundamentally, if they believe that you can make it harder for them to win their next election, they're going to do what you want to do. If they think you can help reelect them, they're going to do what you want to do. And if they think that you can't impact it, you're completely irrelevant. So fundamentally, if there is legitimate, true demand among the people of a city to have more scooters in the fleet and on the streets, and you mobilize that properly, it will happen, right? But one is, I think, we have to see if that demand really materializes. I think in COVID, it was better than people had feared, but still obviously a decline. Two is, how does it work, right? Like, I remember in 2009 when I was running Mike Bloomberg's campaign for mayor, and this was very low tech, but Mike had put bike lanes in all over the city and created the city bike program, which you were here for that, so you remember it. And every time I would have a meeting with like some community leader, their first request was always like something about the bike lanes. Usually take them out, sometimes put more in. I remember one time, I think Oliver mentioned that Jeanette Sada Khan spoke at the conference earlier on. I was meeting with Jeanette, and I didn't even finish my sentence. I just said like, hey, so-and-so, and it was like someone from the Chinese community in Manhattan, and she went crazy, like screaming and yelling at me, cursing at me. I'm not taking out the bike lanes. And finally, I scratched down. I'm like, actually, they just asked for a sign in Chinese saying slow down on the bridge. And she's like, oh, yeah, no problem.
Another hard-charging individual.
Yeah, so these are really hot topics. And I think that for the cap to increase, one, there's got to be voter demand. Two, it has to be working in some sense, right? If it's utter chaos and they're seen as wildly dangerous, it's really hard to expand. Like I heard Oliver mention that there was a moped sharing panel also happening at the same time as this. You know, I know the people at Revel. We're not investors, but I like Frank and the team there. But look, they've got to overcome now this presumption that their product is not safe. I think that they do a good job in trying to make it safe, but that will be their biggest impediment to growth. They have customer demand. They've seen that, but they've also got to be able to show this thing will not kill you. So I think on scooters, it's a little less of a safety risk than perhaps mopeds, but we've got to show demand and we've got to show that it can function in a rational way.
Do you think that so far we've seen that on the demand side, it's certainly easy to see the NIMBY types, the people who are upset with clutter, is the demand strong enough to, or is the passion high enough to rise to
political? So it's a good question. So the demand and the passion, and stop me when I get too granular here about this stuff, but are arguably two different things. So because all the time across my venture portfolio, every CEO basically says to me the same thing, which is do for us what you did for Uber, right? And a lot of times, I have to have this very awkward conversation where I feel like, look, you're great. Your company's great. I think you're great. I wouldn't have invested if I didn't think you're great. But your customers are not going to take time out of their day to call their city councilman's office or text or tweet or whatever it is so that your product can be legalized, or so you get the permits you need, or whatever the particular thing is. So passion is fairly limited to a couple of groups. So clearly it worked in Uber. It has worked in Bird, because, for example, we did that in Miami, and it really worked. I think it works in the cannabis space, which is a little ironic, because you would think that people who are really high would sort of be too lazy to do anything. But at least people who are, there's a company in California called Ease. It's kind of on-demand weed delivery. And when we were running the campaigns to legalize it, people who used medical marijuana, especially who had like really legitimate illnesses that it helped, were very motivated to be out there in public. So there are certain types of customers of certain types of startups who are passionate. It doesn't always translate necessarily to the size of the market or the value of the company itself. So now with that sort of distinction, I guess, drawn, look, the question becomes, or if we are just a niche product for millennials and Gen Zers and some tourists who are in town, or it's a fun way to zip around Austin or whatever, no, I don't think that you'll have the kind of demand you need to materially increase the caps. However, like in New York, and right now the New York City Park Transportation is in the middle of an RFP process to choose two or three operators to start doing electric scooters in New York. But the focus initially will be not in Manhattan, but in the boroughs. And where there's a real need that's interesting is there are these transit deserts in New York City where there's, you know, a neighborhood that is a good 15-minute walk to the subway. And that's kind of a long, I mean, you live in New York, that's kind of a long time. And the weather right now, it's like 18 degrees out right now. I would not want to walk 15 minutes. So I think everyone, both in the state legislature, the city council, and at DOT, and the scooter companies all agreed, look, if we can be the thing that bridges that gap where people can get from their home or their corner to the subway station in 3 minutes instead of a 15-minute walk, that may be a really valuable place to start. And so I think if we prove that out and that we really do meet that kind of demand, then, and assuming COVID ever ends, then yes, I think that's how you build the case. But it can't be a niche business.
Do you, with the New York situation, it's an RFP, right? Or an RFPI, yeah. And they're about to select some operators. New York's been the big holdout in America so far.
They have. Look, you have a mayor who obviously hates technology. And not only does he hate the subway, he only drives. Now the police drive him around. But even when he was a city councilman or public advocate, he drove himself around. Like, he is one of those weird New Yorkers who doesn't use public transportation or any kind of alternate form of kind of micro-mobility service. He just likes to drive in his own personal car, which obviously for climate change and a lot of other reasons is not a great way to be. But Bill de Blasio has got so many negative qualities that his driving is the least of his problems. So look, this is not an administration that was rushing forward to do anything around micro-mobility. But we had a smart DOT commissioner in Polly Trottenberg. She just left to go to work for Buttigieg down in Washington. And I think, the transit desert argument, especially, won so much support from the city council that between them and the state legislators who cared about this, it was enough to finally put it over the top. You mentioned that we're running Andrew Yang's campaign. And I've actually never even talked to Andrew about scooters, but in knowing Andrew, if he or if some of the other like-minded candidates, if any of them win the mayoralty, I think you'll see an embrace of new ideas and new technologies to help people get around.
Yeah, and what do you expect in terms of the reaction from folks when these things are on sidewalks? Do you think it'll be louder or equal to what you've seen in other?
I think it'll be, because we're starting in the boroughs and not Manhattan, which means, when you hear about the reaction, there's the reaction in the community itself. So are people talking to each other when they're dropping their kids off at school, when they're at the playground, at the community board meeting? There's the reaction on social, right? So what's the conversation on Twitter or these days on Discord or, maybe even Reddit if they're not worried about GameStop for a couple of minutes. or what's the reaction in the media, right? So, like, as you know, at least all, with the exception maybe Vice at this point, the media is all still, when they go to physical work, are in Manhattan, right? So if they're not seeing these scooters, I'm not sure how much they're writing about them. Now, I think there's a law that says every
reporter, live in Brooklyn, though.
I was about to say, there's a law that says every reporter has to live in Kara Gardens or Cobble Hill. And if they don't, they'll be thrown out of the Fourth Estate. So they'll see it, and maybe that will spark it. But so it kind of depends on where the noise comes from and which community. But if I had to guess, it'll be similar to other cities. Generally pretty positive because we're solving, if this works, a very tangible problem. And then I think it'll get messier when it comes to Manhattan because, you know, I live in the middle of Manhattan. Like, it's a crazy place, you know. And while I personally believe that scooters should be here, you know, I'm under no illusion that it's going to be an easy introduction.
Generally, do you think that there's, now that this technology seems to be rolling out essentially, you know, a highly regulated, we're going to select three operators for each city. Is there a financial hit to that if this essentially ends up as a government concession?
Yeah. Look, if Bird and Lime, and I, because there's these talk about the SPACs, especially for Bird, I was instructed by counsel that I cannot talk about things like valuations and all of that. But with that said, to be any billion-dollar company, unless you're like a missile manufacturer for the Defense Department, you can't really be a government contractor, right? You can't. It's too niche most of the time. So if there's not a free market and strong consumer demand, then it's hard to see how these companies really, really succeed. Now, the good news is there has been a lot of demand in a lot of cities, and I think that if you told us New York will never be more than a DOT-run concession to help bridge, you know, transit deserts in Mill Basin and Marine Park, Brooklyn, I think we would be pretty dissatisfied with that. If it's, this is the, what you need to do to establish the value proposition and ultimately get to a place in New York where the market can control it, that's worthwhile. So, yeah, as you know, there's a lot of we don't know in the scooter world, anyone that's at least being honest about it. I think that's one of the many we don't know.
On federal policy, you know, there's a new administration. Is there, if any, sort of trickle down from whatever we've gotten so far?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think, look, Buttigieg, who's, you know, the incoming Secretary of Transportation, is one, as we all know, a former mayor. So now look, South Bend doesn't exactly have the same types of transit traffic issues that San Francisco does. But nonetheless, he's got deputies who are people that come out of big city departments of transportation, like colleagues in New York. So I do think, one, there's an understanding of it. Two, for a few different reasons, I think you're going to see Buttigieg be pretty aggressive on tech issues overall. So one, because he's young and he sort of instinctively, I think, sides with new technology. And if you look at kind of the political support and opposition for lots of new kind of technologies, not just in the micromobility space, a lot of it is just age, right? You know, it's really much less about party, for example. And it's almost like if you take same-sex marriage, right? I don't know anyone under the age of 40 or 45, unless you're unbelievably religious, that doesn't support same-sex marriage. And then the number goes down as people get older because social norms change and people's acceptance of things change with it. So I think as a result, Buttigieg is a pretty young guy. He's, what, 37 or something like that, right? So, like, he's going to be temperamentally in favor of moving a lot of these issues forward. And then second, because he's a young guy and he's very ambitious, I can't imagine he's not going for president again at some point. He can't really run in 24 against Biden or Harris, but 28 or sometime in his life, which means he needs to have a track record that people can understand from DOT. And that really means doing things that are interesting for you guys to write about. So it's him figuring out what should the national regulatory framework be on autonomous cars? What should it be on autonomous trucks? How about self-flying drones? How about flying cars, right? I mean, there's no shortage of interesting tech issues that fall underneath the jurisdiction of USDOT. So overall, I would predict that they'll be aggressive about all of this. Whether any of it ends up in the scooter policy, I don't know. That may be a little too parochial for them. But I think that you had 4 years of a very hands-off DOT, especially in the transportation space. Like the FAA was a little better on the drone space. And either it's my belief or at least my sincere hope that that changes.
Yeah, I mean, is there even much potential a federal government could do? I guess it would mostly be sort of funding for things like bike lanes. And, you
know. Yeah, so look, there is a... My brother-in-law is a member of the House and was talking to him the other day, and I said, what do you think the one big thing that you guys could actually get through? And his view was infrastructure, right? Look, I would personally love to see major climate reform and major immigration reform. He's a centrist. He runs this thing called the Problem Solvers Caucus. And his view is that's the thing that they can get through. If that happens, there's going to be upwards of $1 trillion, maybe more now, for infrastructure. So will some of that be for bike lanes, scooter lanes, just EV products overall? Yeah, absolutely.
I guess relating to transit, do you think that how well have scooters and the scooter companies done with sort of interfacing with that world and I guess making a play like, oh, we can augment transit and build up, you know, stations there.
Yeah. I think that in a lot of markets where they came in without explicit permission, they came in on the wrong foot. And look, it was still the right move because being beloved by everyone and not existing is a lot worse than people being annoyed with you and you having an actual successful operating business, right? But I think they had to build and rebuild relationships with local regulators. I think they've done that pretty well in some jurisdictions, probably less so in others. And the companies are also different in how aggressive they are and their tenor and their tone, everything else. And then in terms of how they fit into the broader ecosystem, I don't really know. I would guess that everyone who is taking the time to watch a micromobility conference in some ways may have a better sense than I do as to what the relationship has been like between scooters and other businesses, you know, in the micromobility space.
Do you think, this is a bit further afield, but stay with me. So, you know, we've seen a lot in the past year in California with these bills on the gig economy and regulatory actions on the gig economy where the legislature tried to turn Uber drivers into employees and then Uber's, you know, overturned that. What's your general sense of sort of that sentiment on the national, right? I guess the state by state scale.
So it's an issue that we work on a lot. So I'm like to think that I'm somewhat knowledgeable about it. And so much of it is impacted by two things that happened in November, Prop 22 specifically, and then the margin, November, and then I guess I think it's January as well, of the Democrats in both the House and the Senate. So if Prop 22 had failed, and if there were 252 House members, Democrats, as opposed to 222, and 56 Senate Democrats, as opposed to 50, I think that national legislation on worker classification would have had a shot at actually moving forward and happening. But as we discussed earlier, politicians are extremely sensitive to whatever political input they receive. The goal at the end of the day is to stay in the job. And once they saw that one, Prop 22 won pretty overwhelmingly, and two, you know, Democrats, by having such narrow majorities, not only have less ability to pass more ideological bills, but they just have to pick their spots a lot more, too. Based on all of that, you're not going to see anything, I think, even really seriously be attempted in Congress. So on the federal level, you'll see things come out of the NLRB and out of the Department of Labor. Marty Walsh, who was mayor of Boston, is Biden's nominee to be Secretary of Labor. I think he actually understands a lot of this just probably pretty well because these are often municipal-led issues in terms of how these companies operate. So I think they will try at the margins to chip away at the 1099 status and push people to W-2 because, look, this is the greatest single organizing opportunity for private sector unions in 50 years, right? And Democrats, who generally receive a lot of money from labor, know where their bread is buttered, and they're going to do what they can to move that forward. But on the state level, right after AB 5, if you had asked me, will seven more important states have done the same thing and be W-2 within the next 18 months, I would have said absolutely. Now, it already is, by the way, 18 months later, and the answer is no. And I don't think it'll be the case in 18 months from now either. There's extremely little political momentum for worker reclassification, and it's for a few reasons. One is the obvious, which is the political system coming out of Prop 22 were all kind of very pro-tax. But two, cities and states have bigger problems than that. So because of COVID, everyone are in these like unbelievably large budget deficits. And when times are good, you can be mean to tech and you can be mean to business because you got plenty of tax revenue coming in. And as a result, you can say, hey, we're going to really crack down on short-term rentals or rideshare or scooters or whatever your work classification, whatever you want, and it's fine. All of a sudden, when you're facing budget deficits that for some states are in the tens of billions of dollars, the most important thing is generating new tax revenue and trying to bring back some jobs, right? So you know, I'm sitting here in the middle of New York right now. City's lost, I think, 570,000 jobs since COVID started. The state in total, almost a million. So all of a sudden, your priority goes from winning political favor with small groups of voters who happen to be active primary voters in city council races or state legislative primaries to the bigger picture of we need money, we need jobs. And as a result, you're going to see, I think, startups ironically have better regulatory treatment from local and state government and state government over the next couple of years than they've had in the last few years simply because things are so bad.
That's fascinating. So I think we've got a couple minutes left, so let's take a question on the side here. So do you think that there's going to be tension between the micromobility players and the rideshare companies over some of the open streets bike lane stuff? Is there sort of a collision course there?
Yeah, I mean, look, the rideshare companies have obviously tried to insert themselves into micromobility, so they all pretty much have investments or subsidiaries and interests. So, you know, no one is probably either cleanly just a micromobility company or just a ride-sharing company at this point, with a few exceptions. I'm not that worried about Uber necessarily throwing a fit about losing a lane of car traffic to bike lanes simply because they've got to still at least worry about work classification, even if it's not as big of a threat as it was 18 months ago. And one of the ways also that cities and states are going to plug their budget deficit is they're going to try to raise taxes in lots of different ways. And that will include raising taxes and fees on ride sharing. And so, and that will have a direct decrease in customer demand for the platform. So I'm not super worried about them trying to push back on the micromobility companies over things like space simply because they've got bigger problems.
Here's a mechanics question for advocacy. When competing for a concession in a city, have you found that being based in that city or having a large office there has helped your bid?
Yeah, I do think so. Not to say that you can't win without it, but clearly there's a good political narrative. B, especially in times like this where jobs are really tight, it really makes sense for the mayor to want to say, hey, we just created, you know, 18 new jobs in South Bronx because we awarded this concession to this local company. So, yeah, I do think it's an advantage. Look, it's less of an advantage if there are multiple bidders from your city. But if you're the only one, then a little xenophobia in your campaign may go a long way.
Okay, maybe the last question here. It's open-ended. What's the best way for scooter riders to advocate for more micromobility in cities?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think it is demonstrating that demand to politicians because they're looking to read the political tea leaves. When the voters are saying, I want this, it's a lot easier to do. Now, typically, it doesn't happen without the companies organizing it, right? So people just on their own randomly calling their city council member still has some impact, but it's a lot more disparate. The stuff tends to work better when it's an organized campaign where you can deliver 8,000 calls into a single council member's office, and all of a sudden they're totally overwhelmed by it. But in the interim, yeah, if you're that passionate, go to your community board meetings and speak out in favor of it. Call your council member, call the mayor, write letters to the editor of your local papers and blogs, tweet about it. You know, as we've been seeing the last few days on Wall Street, like in some ways, the power of people through grassroots and technology to accomplish things that, you know, would have been impossible even 15 years ago is pretty remarkable. So no reason that can't apply to micromobility too.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Bradley.
Yeah. Thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah. What an amazing session. Bradley, that was fantastic. And thank you, Elliot, so much for bringing the good questions.